Welcome, everybody. This is the MP Weekly episode 101. 101. So we have only 99 episodes until the next big event, Waldeck. No, just kidding. Every single week is a big event. So BMP Weekly is all about what's the latest within this week across the Microsoft 365 community, MVP, and then typically we have a visitor in the show as well. Before we go there, my name is Vesa Juvonen, and I'm a program manager in the OneDrive SharePoint engineering side, and with me as a co-host is a 3 weeks in Microsoft right now person, right?
Correct. Hi, everybody. My name is Valdemar Stigas. I'm cloud developer advocate at Microsoft, and today we have a guest from Canada, early in the morning. Newly minted dev on the Graph team, Vincent Bray. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, everyone. Hi.
Not super newly minted, right?
It's been 2 months. I'm on my dev role now.
There we go.
So you've been longer in your role than I was in mine. Nevertheless, it's like comparing to Vesa's 14 and a half, 15 years or so, like 2 months is nothing, right?
it's been a long ride. Anyway, so Vincent, you were an MVP before you joined Microsoft. I can see a theme here. We used to have another one in this call as well, who was an MVP, and then moving into the Microsoft. And now you pretty recently moved to a new role. Can you talk about quickly who are you and what's your background, and then let's change and all of that afterwards.
Sure. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I was a SharePoint developer. I started on full trust solutions in the good old days and as a consultant, obviously. And more and more, I've been blogging and involved with a community and participating to open source projects and speaking as well. And this is how I became Microsoft MVP, I guess, 6 years ago now, 2014, something like that. And for anybody who's working in the community or contributing to open source, you should consider the program. It's really good to make new connections, to learn new things. I would really encourage you to check it out and see if you can be part of a program. And after that, because I was complaining so much about things about Microsoft Graph, I had Darrell Miller and Jeremy Fake saying, all right, you complain too much. Come with us. Come fix it, please. I eventually became a program manager for Microsoft Graph back in January, actually. And I've been...
Yeah, it's January this year, right?
Yeah, January 2020.
The 2020 is so weird. It's just...
Yeah, all the blur. There is no time.
January, then February, then March.
So I've been doing program management for the last 7 months in January until August, more or less. And I realized that it was super interesting. I learned a lot. I got to meet a lot of different people across the organization. It's just that my personality was probably not the best fit with a program management role, and I decided to revert to a development role instead. And now I'm on the Microsoft Graph SDK team, so we're the team who builds the SDK, the Graph Explorer, and a bunch of our tools. The dev experience, hopefully, and you can develop with Microsoft Graph in many different languages.
That's a nice change, actually. So that was pretty fast change. Can you actually elaborate slightly? Let's go back on the MVP discussions in a slightly later on this call. But what was the main decision-breaking thing for you to move from a PM role to the developer role? Why did this happen?
There are a couple of points. First, I think there is obscurity. Like, not a lot of people know what a PM is actually at Microsoft. It's a kind of a nebulous role, and especially because it doesn't really exist in any other company. In other companies, you have product owners, you have product managers, not program managers, right? And it's a bit different, right? And I think I took the role not fully understanding what it is exactly. That's the first thing. And then as I learned the ropes and as I discovered the role and so on and so forth, I discovered that, it requires a few affinities or personal skills that were not my favorite things to do. Things like program management is a lot about, you know, influencing people and spending a lot of time in meetings. And this is really important, right? If you don't have a good program manager, you are either spending your time on the wrong things or not doing the things that you should be doing or not being efficient or not coordinated, right? So program managers are really crucial to making sure that something actually lands and something happens. It's just that it was not the right fit for me, right? At the end of the day, after finishing a day of meeting, I had this feeling that I had not done anything. I could not say I had.
I can relate on that heavily.
And also, that was really frustrating to me. And the other thing was that there is a lot of communication on top of that. So a lot of time you'll be on a meeting trying to convince somebody to do this thing this way and not the other way for lots of different reasons. But at the same time, you'll be chatting on Teams on the side, or you'll be replying as emails on the side. And it's very intense days. And it's if you enjoy it, I guess it's much easier to go through that. But I was not enjoying that much. So I decided to go back to my core passions. And for me, down and focus on one specific problem, you know, kind of turning the problem around and figuring out how am I going to solve that and implementing the solution, and then finally having done something works much better with my personality. That's why I decided to make that switch so fast before I burn out, basically.
So with the things you said about the PM role, is it extra hard in Graph, because Graph is the centerpiece that touches everything at 365? So you talk to Outlook, you talk to Teams, you talk to SharePoint, you talk to everybody and anyone, and you have to, you basically need to do that. Like, so it's a lot of juggling, and at the end of the day, you depend on these teams building features, right?
Yeah, so the way it's designed for Microsoft Graph is that you have a core of program managers and developers that work on platform features, for example, things like change notifications or change tracking or throttling or OData support and so on and so forth, right? And then they have to go and convince the different product teams like Outlook, OneDrive, and so on, hey, go use our features because this is going to deliver a great experience for our developers, end-to-end experience, right? But it can take time to coordinate all those people, and also a lot of different discussions, because at the same time I'm having the same discussion about, you know, change notifications with resource data, for example, with OneDrive, I'm having the same set of discussions with Outlook Exchange, I'm having the same set of discussions with To-Do, for example, and so on and so forth, right? So this is how you get it's those are really intensive roles, because again, you have so many people you're talking to at the same time that it gets pretty intense pretty fast.
Yeah, and I think especially now within the cloud, let's say, infrastructure and Microsoft 365, right now, if you have a look on how we're focusing, is that every single feature, we're trying to avoid that it has a competing feature, exactly the same competitive feature across the stack. So there's a one taxonomy service, there's a one a portal service, there's a one, let's say, channel service or whatever. But basically, then that's getting integrated across multiple teams. So it in the past, as a feature PM, for example, in SharePoint, from a house where I'm from, you were able to just focus on a one particular, let's say, a set of people and communicating with them. But now it's cross the organization, cross teams, because you want to make sure that your feature is getting used in an efficient way. But for sure, Graph is probably the most, let's say, communicated or most, let's say, one of the hardest things to manage, because there's so many people.
And I guess also another thing that we've seen the other week, right? Like, for example, when you do a recording in Teams that is now being stored in SharePoint, meaning Teams team needs to talk to SharePoint and OneDrive
to
get the thing. Why? Because that means efficiency. Because instead of Teams team trying to build storage compliancy and all the things by themselves from scratch, well, they can use something that is already there, right?
Yep.
So it's on one hand efficiency. There is some other group with their life cycle, their work, and you need to align for both things to actually work together. So,
and then there's if we think about, let's go back on the actually let's talk about slightly the PM role, and then because we touched it a few times, but in general, if you think about the PM role in Microsoft, it's the person who's responsible of creating specs and owning the feature. So it's kind of the owning of the solution. So kind of defining what should be done now. Depending on organization, that might mean functionality or it might actually need a technical way of implementing things. That's, that really depends on the organization, because in OneDrive SharePoint, as an example, we have PMs who do not define anything related on code. But then we have PMs who also define the code level. So it, it is really dependent on the persona as well.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in Microsoft Graph, at the end of the day, you're working on an API, right? So you have to have a strong development experience and design, architecture design skills, and so on and so forth, and get deep dive in the designs. Otherwise, it's just not specific enough for the teams to implement something, basically.
Yeah. Right? Then, as in the PM role, you need to also be in touch with the customers and partners and communities. So you need to understand what actually is the requested capabilities. You need to be able to communicate those with your management chain and in the priority chain, so people actually can then stack rank your feature and so do you actually get the developers for the feature, which is an interesting challenge as well. So kind of a justifying, hey, I need to do X and Y and Z, and I need five people. Well, you get three. No, I need five. No, you get three. And it's,
So you're like, yeah, but I want a five. You get three. I want a five. You get two. You're like, what?
But it, and then as a PM, you're also responsible of whenever the feature is ready, you're ultimately responsible that it actually matches what we are specing, so making sure that it's actually matching the capabilities and features, and then communicating that to the partners. So sure, there are technical writers who are then specialized on the language and all of that, but you need to explain for the technical writers whatever you actually created and why does it exist and why is it the coolest thing ever, and then they share that to
so world. So as a PM, is there something you actually do not do?
Well, yeah, it is actually fair point. It is the
the responsibility to make sure that the feature or the feature set lands right.
Yeah.
And as Vesa said, you have this period of negotiation with different teams to say, I need resources for that to happen. And sometimes you don't get your resources. So sometimes you need to bridge the gap a little bit. Of course, you're not going to do as much as a good job as the dedicated team would have done at this point. But at least it would allow your feature to see the day of light, the light of day, and then, right? So this is why you kind of end up doing a lot of different things at the same time, because if something is not coordinated on time or if something is not available for you, well, you're ultimately the one who it falls on.
Yeah, it's an interesting role for now. Yeah. And then in many cases, and I think it's the same in the graph as well, the PM role is how you define that role as well. So you have a lot of kind of freedom on the boundaries of, well, you need to still ship, but still kind of define the role and decide the development cycles and all of that in the way you want them to be. So so as an example, I still remember with Mikael Svensson when he moved into the Microsoft Search organization. Mikael is an ex-MVP as well. He was kind of amazed on, hey, so nobody's telling me what I'm supposed to do. I'm able to define the role which is kind of cool. And that's how it should be, because this is not kindergarten. So you need to find the right ways of influencing, right ways of delivering on the boundaries of whatever is your responsibility as well. So,
But I guess if you, even there, right, like, depending how you join, the level where you come, you're joining new org, new job, which you might or might not know, right? And then depending on that, like, you might be able to do that work by yourself already, or maybe you need some guidance saying, okay, so we're going this direction and this is how we approach things. So the first reasonable step towards that is to do this, you know? It's like,
yeah.
And I guess one of the things that I heard, and I'm not sure if it's true, but it makes sense, is that when you join as a PM, like, the scope of your work increases the more seniority, maturity you get. So the more experience you get, the bigger feature sets you get.
Yep.
So absolutely. It's interesting because Microsoft approaches the experience and the progress in a company kind of like in a video game, right? Or you have levels and you level up as experience, right? Yeah, as a program manager too, because this is how I started when I joined Microsoft, I was responsible for 3 to 4 features in Microsoft Graph and at the end of the day. But there are some principal program managers, so 2 levels above me, who had almost a dozen different features. And to me, this is impressive because I don't know how they can coordinate so many things, right? Because as you have 12 features, you have 12 times as much
connection points, yeah,
emails and meetings and stuff. So I don't know how they do that. To me, that's still a big question mark. But
but that's actually a good way how you defined it. That it's being a PM. One of the things which coming back on my historical thing. So I left my previous company and moved to Microsoft because I ended up being the guy who's getting connected on everything. So whenever there was a question related on the platform, I got tracked in.
And so where are you now exactly?
Thank you. But basically, which is precisely where I was heading, because I wanted to go to Microsoft, which is such a large company that you can never be on the centralized position. But then being a PM in a certain level, you actually ended up being the central point of connection, because that is actually your job. And one of the challenges of being a PM is that you need to able to manage also the fact that you cannot communicate or cannot even respond to all of the people who are reaching to you. So you need to be able to manage that prioritization. And I think we're going to talk about the inbox zero in a few different perspective in later on this call, because I think that relates on that. So if you are a PM owning multiple features or a large, massive feature set, there's just no way to get to the inbox zero as an example. It's just impossible. And then you need to learn not to feel bad about the fact that you haven't had a chance to respond, which is actually really hard. It depends on how empathetic you actually are for the other people, because basically there's people asking help and you're like, well, I would love to help, but I just can't. So it's an interesting challenge. But now coming back on your current role, Vincent, so how is it then different for a developer and engineer in Microsoft? So how would you define that? Sorry, Baldek, if you had a comment on there.
No. It's perfectly good. So an engineering role is where your responsibility is ultimately to figure out the solution, build, test, ship, and keep alive the service if you're a developer on the service side, right? I work on SDKs, so we don't maintain a service, but a lot of in the cloud era, a lot of people are building services at the end of the day, right? And one thing I like about that is that you get some sense of ownership. You get to feel accomplished about having built something and shipped something. Yeah. And you also get to focus on something. When my PM, who until recently was Daryl Milner, told me, hey, Vincent, I need you to figure out why this is broken in the Java SDK and how we can fix it and so on. Well, I just say, all right, thank you, Mr. PM. I'll go take this and I'll go fix it, right?
In a month.
That you can't do, because at some point there is back this the PM is like, hey, is it done yet? Right? That's also the role.
Because the PM is getting pressured on getting it done. So
like partners or management and so on, right? So you also need, you still, like, it's not a completely ivory tower kind of role, an engineering role, right? You still need to communicate with your peers, with your management, with the program managers to make sure that we're all advancing in sync. And if there's any issues, we tackle them together and not individually. But again, you get more time to focus on things. You get more time to think and so on and realize things. So this is, to me, those are the big differences. And also because you're more focused, you have to some extent less people that you're talking to all the time, to some extent. Because the flip side of that is now that our SDKs are open source, they're all on GitHub, so you have a whole community that can rush and come comment and create issues and so on, and you need to also to manage that aspect. And this is one aspect I like about working on the SDKs, is that when you work on a service, you're kind of hidden in the back end in the service, right, from the community. As the developer on the SDKs, I still get to use that kind of community foo that I learned over the years as an MVP and now as a developer, right? So
And I have to say, by the way, before we continue, we somehow magically made the PM role look really bad on this. So it's not actually, it depends on the persona, obviously.
But, yeah, of course. But, it's a personal aspect, right? So if you're personality makes it so that you like, you know, influencing people, talking to a lot of people, being more on the communication aspect, go for a PM role. It's amazing. You can have a really broad impact on the organizations and on the planet, right? It's just that make sure you know yourself and you know about the role before you do that. Because otherwise it might be difficult for you, right? So
I think for a big part that like being effective in this role means that you have to be able to organize yourself well, and then you have to have these entrepreneurial spirit of I want to take this thing and to take it from an idea all the way to fruition. Mm-hmm. And that means basically lobbying for interest resources, coming from an idea, bouncing it off others, and basically doing all this work.
That is actually one of the interesting things, which is probably not that visible also outside of the engineering in Microsoft, is that there's actually quite a lot of the startup mentality in these teams. And so the teams stuff, it's you are part of a bigger company, but basically the team itself, which is building stuff, is always responsible of kind of making that startup to fly, and then recruit the right people in, get the right people, and then build the stuff. And then you never have enough resources, that's just given, and you're always complaining and trying to prioritize, and then you need to pitch the idea forward and basically get additional resources and commitment.
That is how you build a product. And the interesting thing is, it's exactly the same for a company of five and a company of the Microsoft scale, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there is always more ideas than hours in a day. There's always more ideas than resources you have available.
But I would have to say that it's obviously part of the company culture as well, because you might have a large company which is based on top-down mentality, not the other way around.
That scale.
Does it work nowadays? I don't know.
But I mean, it also depends, I think, very much on what you build. I can imagine that, like, if you build a car or you build building, well, you need to have, like, there's a structured thing, because, like, the further down the line you find an error, well, the more expensive it is. Whereas in software, I mean, like, imagine that at Microsoft size, like, the Teams team would like to build something and they need to align with 100,000 other people, like, you wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's in a way, I think, really the only way to do something is to make teams independent in a way and give them the free choice to say, okay, as Microsoft, we have a vision, mission, this is the way we go, and teams align with that, filling in the blanks for their features.
Yeah.
I would probably say that the main difference between a smaller company and Microsoft is you get some support from the company. For example, if your team's building your new product and solution and so on, and you think that, hey, we need an API to be able to access those things, right? Because you're at Microsoft, you already have people that have thought about API design and architecture, that have built libraries, that can help you and mentor you through
security,
the
process. Uptime, deployment, and 20 million other things.
Yeah.
You don't need to figure out everything, right? There are some pieces that you can reuse, and actually are bonus structure is very well organized in a way that you are reusing people's stuff instead of reinventing the wheel all the time, right?
Yeah.
So I guess that's one of the main advantages of driving a product at Microsoft versus doing it at a smaller company, right? So,
well, and I mean, you can always say, hey, I have a colleague who knows whatever it is. Is it right? Because, like, there is a chance that somebody at Microsoft somewhere knows about whatever it is that you need, whether you need YAML or IoT or DevOps or security or operating system low-level things or Android. Or company is so big, like, that there must be someone somewhere, right? So the only thing is, like, can you get to that person on time?
Or right now, especially right now, if you think about 2020, when we are recruiting more people working remotely, then helping those people to find the network and those connections inside of company is super critical. And I think that's an area where we'll see a lot of, let's say, external Microsoft innovation, but also internal Microsoft innovation, and hopefully learnings, which we can share for the partners and customers around that. Because Waldeck, you're a good example. You never met physically any of your teammates, and you need to build that network of connections. In your case, you are an ex-MVP, so you kind of know a lot of the MVPs, external, and also people who moved into the Microsoft. But still, Is it different than walking to an office and then knowing everybody and have those connections? Or?
Well, I don't know. Like, to be honest, I've never really experienced one being prerequisite for the other. So, like, for me, I worked remotely for 4.5 years, almost 5 now. So for me, it's just like realities of life. Yeah, like, you don't always get to meet each other in person, and I don't see that as prerequisite. Sure, it takes time to build a relationship with someone else, but I don't see the in-person aspect being key factor in that. Like, if you put in the effort and you have even calls right now, like, that for me is also like kind of current times equivalent of doing things in person as opposed to asynchronously on IM.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, I guess we're all working remotely for numbers of years, so there is nobody to counter argument us. But
going back, right?
I completely agree. And even like the office culture can only scale so much. Like if anybody listening who hasn't been to a Microsoft campus in Redmond, I encourage you to go just on Bing Maps, let's call it, and just zoom from a satellite view. There are hundreds of buildings, multiple stories. It's a city. So it's more likely, especially if you work on Microsoft Graph, that even if you're in the office, in the building physically, you'll be talking about with people across the whole campus, right? So.
Yep.
So at the end of the day, you need to be able to build relationships remotely and so on. And I guess the only big difference it makes is after work, where if you work in an office, you know, you can go grab a drink with your colleagues and so on and so forth. That's the only aspect where you're limited when you're working remotely.
Yeah.
And even that you can do online now. So
there's a lot of positive health benefit out of that.
Well,
so you don't go to drinks and you don't drink that
depends,
much, right?
Well,
so.
Depends on a drink, right? But there's also an interesting thing that I experienced the other day, right? So especially in my team, like, my team is distributed across the world.
Yeah.
So for me, the only time really where the work stops is weekend.
Yep.
Because we have team in I have two colleagues in Australia. So when their day finishes, my starts, and then when my day is finished, then the US starts, and then by the time US is done, Australia starts.
Yep.
So it's like, if you want, you could be working 24/7 because there's like all the time there is somebody online.
Yep.
So like, absolutely, you really need to learn, like, it's perfectly fine to miss things. I will miss things. That's by design. I need to miss things. Otherwise, I will go crazy.
Yeah, well, not necessarily miss things, but just defer those, right? And when you were mentioning those async ways of working, well, do that. Make sure you set up quiet hours, because as your colleagues are working in Australia, you don't want to be woken up at 3 a.m. because they're chatting with you, expecting you to reply.
The phone.
And all those things, right? But I guess working remotely is a matter of taking up good habits to be in a good mental space and be in a productive workflow. But once you made the transition, I don't think I'm ever going back to an office, to be honest with you guys.
Well,
once you learn,
been in an office together, so there is nothing really to go back to, right?
Yeah, but I don't see myself actually in the traffic jams in commutes waiting for Tribe the summer would suck. Why? Because
exactly,
all of this possibilities are now available. And now, lucky, kind of due to the 2020 situation, we are forced to learn to actually use this tooling efficiently, which is great, because it enables then people to work remotely and maybe have a better and maybe healthier work-life balance. Who knows? In our case as well, we have a development center in China, in India. I'm in Finland, and then Redmond. It's like, and I have my sleeping times in the calendar, so people know that I'm not going to take times for those. So I have family time also marked on calendar just in case.
Yeah.
So it's just the easiest way to deal with the with the different time zones. So I just got just as recently as today, there was an invite for midnight on Friday heading to Saturday. It's like, yeah, no, thank you.
It's like, oh, this meeting, so cool. Not doing it.
Exactly. more articles, and let's get back on the discussion after that for a few minutes. So let's and we have a good discussion related on. I'm waiting for the discussion related on inbox zero on here. But let's start with a few blog posts, the new ones from Microsoft. So this one's the only new one in Microsoft Teams block. So there's a
High five.
Oh, that's okay. Of course it is. Never mind. So a partner story related on High Five employee app, which integrates now to Microsoft Teams. So a nice way of showing how it integrates. And the key point here, again, is that the application, you don't need to go to another location. The application will be exposed in the same location where you are working. So that's actually the advantage of doing this. And integration options are really easy. So you can easily do this. A team. So good showcase on the partner story. And this one is from the SharePoint community blog. So learning and networking days, two free one-day events from the European Collaboration Summit event team. So there's two different days coming. So there's the Collab and Cloud Learning Day, where there's three workshops, and then there's a European Networking Day coming as well. So 26th and 27th of October, so within a week from now. Depending on when you're watching the video, it might be that you missed it. Now, or listening to podcast, you never know. And this one is from the Microsoft 365 developer blog. So a new announcement related on general availability of Microsoft Graph Teams membership API. So basically getting access on the members in the groups and access on there. So pretty cool. Just a note maybe for the future, maybe we should have actually talked about the scenarios and features and why this is important, what does it enable more efficiently. But
maybe we can bridge the gap. Provisioning. I don't know if you've been working on provisioning solutions, but when you create different aspects or different artifacts across Microsoft 365, thanks to Microsoft Graph and our awesome SDKs, if the service takes time to replicate changes, it can be really painful to design your solution in a way that it has to wait and check again and come back maybe when it's ready. And so these endpoints are here to alleviate that, where when you provision a team and it's ready to be used, instead of waiting from the sync between Azure Active Directory and Teams to happen, but sometimes can be a bit slow, you can talk right away to Microsoft Teams and they'll do the replication for you, and it should be much faster. So yeah.
Awesome. Really cool.
Like I said, it took up to 48 hours to appear the changes in the past. And that's...
So let my provisioning thing wait now for 48 hours because I created a team and I have 20 million other teams to create. So
yeah. It's an async way of working, right?
Exactly. Like I'm so
go do something else.
It's gonna come. I don't know when, but it's gonna come.
Yeah. Cool. Now, this one is the Vincent, your blog post related on your personal experiences as a program manager and switching back to the development. I think we touched pretty much all of the topics in here, but it's a good written story related on what does a program manager do and what does the developer do and who do program managers work with?
Everyone.
Anything what we missed from this side? Anything drinking from fire hose?
Yeah, we didn't talk too much about the metrics, like how many emails I got and all those kind of things, and the tips I give for people that want to take the role. But that's a good cue for you guys to go check out the blog post and get more details this way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks for that one. This one really good because it's the sharing the personal experiences related on roles is super, super important. And I can imagine that this has a lot of looks and a lot of views. So good. This one is from Hugo, popular PMP repositories, meaning Microsoft 365 community repositories and how to get started on contributing. So all of the different repos which are available, he updated this pretty recently with additional repos like Microsoft Graph, .NET Client Library, which are also taking contributions. They're driven by the engineering and the design decisions done by engineering, but they also take contributions. Is that the right way of saying that, Vincent?
So we have a few libraries that we maintain ourselves as the Microsoft Graph SDK team, and we also have a few libraries that we want the community to contribute in. And the reason why we separated those is because a lot of the code we actually have is generated. So that means that next time the Microsoft Graph schema is going to be updated, we are going to kick a new generation process, and it's going to erase any manual changes that you might have made. So we want to make sure that there are clear boundaries, and it's easier, you know, there are not thousands of classes and so on and so forth. So it makes it much easier for the community to navigate and contribute and to the SDKs by separating the boundary, basically.
Yep. Absolutely, absolutely. And like I said, that's a good point, because code is auto-generated and it's always up to date, well, with the 1 week or delay or whatever, how often they're refreshed. There's no way for contributing on exactly on those. Now, there's other ways of contributing, like if you find a typo in docs, all of that is absolutely welcome for Graph as well, across the Microsoft Teams and all of that. And then there's samples, which are a separate thing, samples which are contributed by either by the Microsoft people or by the community, because we certainly want to surface the community contributions in the different galleries as well. So really cool stuff. Good list of things from Hugo. Now, analyze Microsoft 365 user profile photos using Azure Computer Vision API and CLI for Microsoft 365. Pretty cool setup, actually, from Joseph Velia. And so explaining how you can actually do analyzing of the photos. I think we had a community demo doing something similar automatic detection with the Vision API.
I think that was done in WebMars, in SPFX. Yeah. So you would upload a picture and then it would say whether it's according to company guidelines or not. Yeah. And then you've uploaded a picture of a dog.
Yep. And so, this one is basically just crossing all of the different user profile photos and then analyzing them.
Can I make one suggestion for all of our IT pros bloggers out there? If you're writing PowerShell or Bash or any kind of shell experience here, put your script on gist.github.com, and this way you'll be able to embed the script and you'll get syntax coloration
highlighting
automatically, right? So it makes it easier for people to read it. And if people want to copy your script, they just need to download the file where it's hosted. It makes things much easier than just, you know, a script and plain text like that.
There is one, but these scripts don't come through in your RSS readers.
Fair enough.
So it's like,
Fair enough, yeah.
So, yeah.
But good point, absolutely. Now, moving on the articles, this one is from Elio. What is the right approach to cache data in your solution? So talk about the different caching options, so just the session storage and local storage, and what are the limitations related on those things as well. So good blog post. Elio is the technical lead of the Valo intranet. So he makes these decisions in the Valo. So a lot of experiences around these topics as well.
Yeah, and also like first things first, why would you cache? Well, you want to, because otherwise there is the latency, there is the services that you are calling over and over again, trying to get the same data. So it's just way more efficient and faster if you have the data once and it didn't change. Well, then there is no need for you to retrieve it.
So a simple example of a caching, a super old scenario, but I'll still remember this because it took a while for us to figure out what was wrong. We were building a global intranet for 30,000 employees, and then there was a web part which was showing a survey. And this was way behind, like years and years in a farm solution, doesn't matter. But the web part was showing a survey, and then it was supposed to show the survey results if the person has already responded on that. And the survey results were basically the results. We wanted them to get refreshed automatically. So whenever somebody else is replying on the survey, because it's a front page of the portal, we want that to be reflected on the page.
Okay, oh wait.
And the person who implemented that kind of thought about it, then okay, not a problem. So they get a timer, and it was hitting the server for updated the data in every 100th of a second.
Oh, so, and that is server-side code hitting your farm.
Correct.
Good luck.
So now in the Monday or Tuesday when we went live, 9 a.m. in the morning, 20,000 employees come to work. They open up the browser, which is default. Every single one is asking 100th of a second updates on the server. And the servers went, phew, and we were like, what?
So does that mean that they refresh the page like 10 times a second? No, right?
No, the section of the page. So it's just the image.
An iframe.
So, yeah.
Or Ajax call.
Exactly. Ajax call. Wow. But 100th of a second per user who had the page open times 20,000.
It is important, right? If there was another vote, well, you have to see it immediately, like real time. You have to see like, boom, there's like another reply. All
right. So, but that was a surprisingly difficult thing to figure out because it was such a like, what's happening? Because you see everything going.
Who's pressing F5 all the time? And there's like there's a cat lying somewhere on a keyboard, like.
On their
cool. Anyway. Horror stories from the past. Now this one from Stefan, how to identify the fonts rendered in your process. A good story actually related on what's getting rendered and where and how things are getting rendered in the process as well. And also how SharePoint as an example handles all of this, the fonts. So and it actually, I think this one is the one where he's calling out a slightly more differences between the different tooling as well. So there's is it Apple iOS or is it a Windows? There was a difference how the things are getting rendered. So really cool blog post explaining the differences as well. So this one is from the guy called Waldeck in this call. You want to actually talk about that?
Sure. So oftentimes when we talk to developers or ISVs, we kind of assume that they know about like why would you build things on M365. They are already sold and they're looking just for okay, so how? But that is like that assumption isn't always right. So at times we end up talking about technologies and SDKs and APIs and whatnot, and they're like, yeah, well, why would I do it? Why would I be interested? Like, what is incentive for me to build apps on that? Why would I would I integrate? So with that article, I aim to explain like the first steps, like why would you be interested in that? What is the benefits? And then once you think like, hey, that sounds interesting, I want to give it a try. Well, then there are the next steps for sign up for the dev program, try Graph and other things. But that comes afterwards, only after you understood why would you actually even look into that?
Why would you even go and sign up for the Microsoft 365 developer program? Because you want to do something in this platform. Why do you want to do something in this platform?
There are 250 million reasons for that.
Exactly. So, and I think in general, we need to do a better job on explaining this exact story. So the opportunity around the Microsoft 365 platform, this is coming up in so many discussions with partners, and they don't quite understand the opportunity and what you can do with it. With the platform. Azure is much more, let's say, mature from a messaging perspective, and it's more clear. It's set of tools, and
then
you combine
also,
the tools.
Right?
Exactly.
It is the building blocks in which you integrate, whereas here, whereas like there's this huge data set into which you can tap, and that is the value, and you can extend that, and you can use it in your own app. So there's like 20 million things that you can include in your app and enrich your apps with, other than the raw building blocks, like this is where you store the data, this is your serverless, here you build an API.
Yeah. The existing data is really the key. And that's why we have the awesome Graph API, so you can get access on the awesome existing data. So.
And even with the SDK, so it's even faster and you have less code to write.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's foolproof. You get design time checks, type safety, will not break on runtime.
And you get retry handlers, so if the service is not
being
propling and so on, you get all of that for free.
Absolutely. So that's why the SDKs are so important. Now, this one is also interesting. When did we started talking about this one while I quit you, like six months ago?
July. No, I think we started about it in around May, June, I think.
Something like that. So, but this is actually really interesting. We did some experiments already at that time, but thank you for and spending the time of writing the actual story related on the me experience in Microsoft Teams. And this is basically under the SharePoint framework or built for Microsoft Teams and explaining how different aspects and scenarios on how you build your personal dashboard, either using modern pages or then creating a web part or a personal application to surface that stuff in multiple different ways. There's different advantages and disadvantages in both. So
exactly.
So And this is really intended to be kind of a showcasing of how and what you can build in the Microsoft Teams. And should you use SharePoint framework? Well, that's actually a secondary thing. It could be a SaaS application which you're hosting by yourself.
Exactly.
It's the concept which matters. Or the easiest way to do this, absolutely, is by you embedding the SharePoint directly in Teams, and then if that's sufficient for you, again, multiple aspects and considerations. So,
yep.
Cool. And then this one, we needed to talk about
Inbox Zero. Yeah.
So, can you briefly your perspective, Waldeck, on this one, and then Vincent can actually explain his perspective.
So, like over the last, I think, year and a half or so, like I've been in different job when I worked on a product. And as typically that's the case, you have more ideas than hours in a day. So you end up creating these to-do lists that fewer items go off than you put on, because there's another idea. And you can only do so much, right? And then is the same thing applies to your email. Like you can try to catch up on everything and read on every single email, but then like you will end up just reading email the whole day and not doing anything else, right? So... So with that, I am not really the thing that like whether you keep everything in your inbox or move it to archive, but rather like trying to be in this race to get everything done. Like because that is like I found out the hard way that is really a trap, because you will end up working and there's like no matter how many hours you put in, you will never really be done. Because there will always be more. It never, in products, it never stops.
I agree with most of that. I think the angle of the Inbox Zero thinking is not to give you more work, though, to do, you know, all the work that is possible, but more to make it so you're set up in a way that you have only the important work coming and getting your attention. And you don't have a cognitive load anymore of things that are not important. And to illustrate that example, I'll say that, for example, if we take emails, I don't think the goal is to read every single 2,000 email that you get every day, but more to make it so you unsubscribe to a few things, or you set up automatic rules that if you see a pattern of things that doesn't call for action, doesn't give you an interesting information, you should not be on that email to begin with. Because of distribution list or something like that, well, you just delete it automatically and mark it as read, right? So you go from 2,000 emails a day to maybe only 200, for example.
Still insane, but...
Yeah. And, well, it depends on perspective.
And by doing that, you make sure that your tools to track work do not get out of control, because that, like having a bucket list or a list of things to get done that is getting out of control, generates tremendous stress, and also you lose your ability to get some context awareness, knowing that, hey, that is a priority, I need to get attention and focus on that, and that is not a priority. If you cannot even have a global picture of whatever priorities anymore, you cannot make those decisions anymore, and this is where it only goes downhill from that point on. So yeah.
But then is it an Inbox Zero or is it something else? What works? It doesn't actually matter. This is highly subjective. Different methods work for different people. There's no absolute yes or no. So in my case, as an example, I don't use Inbox Zero, but I have a me folder. So whenever somebody sends an email where I'm actually in the to list, it lands on my me folder, which is the only folder where I actually work. Because if I'm CC'd, it's a carbon copy. So I don't need to worry about that one. It's not intended to me to actually react on it. So only those emails where I'm actually explicitly in the to list are the ones which I'm interested. And then a few different DLs. But
that people had email points before they could send any email. Like they would get 10 email points a day, or they could send 10 emails a day. That's it.
Yes.
Are you really
quota.
Sure?
Yes, a quote.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great idea, actually.
Edit, and then you would be able to store the points in their profile in Graph, and it's being reset every midnight.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's a great idea. That is a Exchange PMs or wherever we will implement that. That's actually a great idea to manage the email stress. You could be able to do that. you would have to have an integration in the Outlook. That's actually a great idea.
So you can say that the longer the email, the more credit it costs.
Or the more people you have on there. Because there are a lot of people putting in tons of distribution lists.
Yep.
So there's a whole scoring formula, how many credits it costs you. Like, this email is going to cost you X. Are you sure you want to send it?
Yes. So that is a brilliant idea. I think that would help on a lot of the companies to reduce the information overload. So So if somebody is listening, it's like, hey, I need to build that. Please do. And then make a chillin' out of money on that. So that is a really good idea. So I'm pretty sure that in the current world, the chaotic world, that would be easily, people would actually adapt that. So that's actually great. Now, hopefully we just made some people millionaires, right?
You heard it here first.
Maybe there is already an application with SASTAT, which we're just not aware of that. Anyway, and this one is from AC, Andrew Connell. How does the SharePoint framework work? We talked about some of these series articles already last time, but I think now the series is full. So really having what is the SharePoint framework, what you can build with that, why did we introduce it, and how does the SharePoint framework work? So really nice series, not focusing only on SharePoint, but also on Microsoft Teams, because that's absolutely one of the target extensibility points for SharePoint framework as well. Now, this one is from Agnes, how to deploy BMP Modern Search Web Parts. So really explaining where you can get the BMP Modern Search Web Parts, which enables you to build modern SharePoint experiences. So this is something what Frank Cornu, Mikael Svensson, and a few other people have been building in the past years. So really cool stuff. And Agnes is basically just walking by step on how to get started and how do you build that experience. So really cool. Really, really cool. And it actually starts by creating the app catalog, which is required for the solution to get targeted. We are, by the way, in progress of figuring out how do we pre-provision app catalog because we need to. So making that available for everybody. But that's a long side discussion. There's different aspects on that one. SharePoint Syntax, first steps with intelligent content type and compliance from John Klein. So really cool stuff as well, walking through the scenarios. And what's really cool about the Syntax Content Center is that you can actually create this example content, example structures. So you can actually create this and you can generate that with an example content. And then that will show you how you can detect, for example, the invoice related information and do calculations and teach the syntax and then the automated stuff. So really, really cool stuff. So. And then the last from Robert Crane, custom praise badges in Microsoft Teams. So how can you actually go to the Microsoft team and then in the praise application settings, you can actually modify the different settings and different badges. If you don't like the out-of-the-box ones or the default ones which are available, you can introduce your own with their own images and all of that. And then you can give those praise badges for people.
Very cool.
Good, that's the articles. So inbox zero today.
Totally, every day. Every day, inbox zero.
Yeah.
So Vincent, the one thing that I want to ask, and that is not related to our inbox zero thread, you mentioned that you work on SDKs, right? And you mentioned that majority of the code is generated, is coming from the API, so that the coverage of the SDK is always full API surface, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where do you see the room for a community to contribute to SDKs?
Oh, there's lots of rooms. For example, we have this notion of handlers in the SDK, in the core part of the SDK, and those handlers will handle things like throttling, for example, how long should I wait before I retry, or they handle things like compression, or they handle other things, right? That are more cross-cutting concerns, right? And as much as we have ideas, we might not think about everything, or as much as we have time, we don't have time to do everything as well. So there's lots of rooms for people to contribute here in their favorite language into those different handlers to make sure that we add some cross-cutting capabilities. We also have in the .NET Contrib SDK, we have a lot of helper methods, for example. You might know that Microsoft Graph returns dates with a time zone. So there is this kind of date time zone offset object. I never remember the name of that. Right? And in .NET, we have a lot of helper methods that help you go from that to native date time offset objects and so on and so forth, right? And yep. There is not necessarily the equivalent of that in the other mm-hmm. languages. So that's another area of contributing. And you know, those little helper functions will end up saving tons of times to thousands of or hundreds of thousands of developers around the world, right? At the end of the day. So this is where there's a lot of room for contributions. There are also other languages where we don't necessarily it hasn't reached prime time yet because we're still working on that and just giving feedback on is it working? Is it working well? Is it easy to use? Does it make sense in that language to write things in this particular way? Is already helping us a lot as well. I'm thinking about, for example, the Microsoft Graph CLI or the Python SDK that are very early in their days today, but that should mature to become really production ready, basically, right? So, because again, we as developers have favorite languages and biases towards those favorite languages. So right. I might design a thing in, I don't know, Python, for example, that is a bit too much .NET-y or JavaScript-y, and that doesn't make a lot of sense for the Python community, for example.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, for example, for .NET, are those partial classes? So you could be easily then extend the output, because that would be one way of also just abstracting additional layer on top of the SDK. I don't know if they are, because I haven't checked.
So for the .NET one, they are partial, yes. So you can technically add methods, additional methods.
That's what I'm thinking, because then you could easily actually just abstract on top of that, then different scenarios without, and because we auto-generate, and the graph is backward compliant, typically, unless we explicitly call it out in blog posts, then your code would not get broken with the later versions, because you just abstract on that.
Now, of course, the only thing is the partial concept is a .NET concept. So, for example, partial aspect does not have an equivalent, as far as I know, in Java, for example, right?
Fix that. No, just kidding.
Fix that. Well, go convince the Java devs to potentially break backward compatibility. But in JavaScript, you do that. You can do that through prototype or through type extension with TypeScript, for example, and so on and so forth. There are a number of ways to also inject code in the CodeGen part without touching the CodeGen files if you want to. All right.
Cool. And I know that there's a lot of more additional investments on this area, which is good. We get stuff.
Maybe I can give a sneak peek to people. One of the things we've been investing a lot lately is revamping our authentication and authorization story to use Azure Identity. So the Azure team came up with this new library, which uses MSAL under the covers for most of what they're doing. To standardize the way you configure and use the authentication through the Microsoft Identity Platform or Azure AD. And we historically had those kind of glue libraries, the SDK name-auth or something like that, to help us glue between MSAL and our SDKs. And then we felt, wait a minute, why are we doing those glue libraries when Azure already did it? And it would make much more sense for the developers to have one experience for authentication and authorization. And with regardless if they're using, I don't know, Azure Bot Storage or Azure Key Vault or Microsoft Graph, it should always be the same code and the same story. So that's one thing we're spending a bit of time on lately to make sure that you have, as developers, as consumers, a consistent authentication and authorization experience.
Yeah, and which is always the most important thing. Make that section as simple as possible, then people will learn the tooling, because then you get easily access on things. So,
of course.
So with that, is there any place people can go to, give it a try, give you feedback? Do you have a link, URL, repo?
Well, we can go on the different, depending on the language, your favorite language, you can go on the different JavaScript or .NET or Java repos and so on and so forth. All of that is pretty much still work in progress at this point. I think maybe the .NET one has something ready to use, but I'm not sure. I would have to double check on that. Again, we will be reaching out to the community and to you guys so you can spread the message, especially you as a cloud advocate, to help us get some feedback around those things as soon as it's a bit more ready for prime time. But yeah, it's going to be on the different languages repos, so it's going to be there to find and to try and to complain about if it's broken or not working.
The normal process, absolutely. Yeah, and that would be https://github.com/microsoftcraft, where people can go and find the relevant repos. Yeah.
Under that, we have 100 and something plus repos. So the easiest thing is to type your language, for example, like .NET or Java or Python, and it will bring the different repos for the language you care about eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I think that sums up. We're breaking the 1 hour limit again, apparently, on this call, which we're trying to keep under 1 hour, hitting the lunch hour time frame. But anyway, so thank you, Victor. Thank you, Vincent, not Victor. That went really well.
That's okay. I like Victor. He's always very well dressed, so I'll take that as a compliment. Don't worry.
So,
know your guest.
Exactly. It's Monday. Thank you, Vincent, for this one. Really good discussion. And it's good to have that discussion related on sharing more understanding of the differences between the roles and how things work, because I think that's always super beneficial for people to understand also externally. So if somebody wants to go to a Microsoft as a PM, they understand what is expected and as a developer. But I think that's it for this one. So Waldeck, any last words from your side? You can close it today.
Thanks. What was that?
You can close it today, this week.
Yes, so long, and thanks for all the fish.
Yeah, thank you for having
me. Thanks, Vincent. Cheers.
Thank you, Vincent.
Thank you, everybody, for watching and listening. Bye-bye.